Jag heter Per Granqvist och det här, det är Perspektiv.
The problem was that when you're like working in a company and all of a sudden like it gets bought and like it's starting to do criminal things, it's like you can't go to like HR and be like, can I like file like a complaint against the entire company for being criminal?
En sak som jag har tänkt mycket på de senaste åren, det är vem eller vad som formar ens världsbild. För samtidigt som faktenfrågan numera bara är en sökning bort, det är ju lögnen också det. Och det där hur man skiljer mellan sant och falskt, det är inte bara ett resultat av algoritmer som skapar filterbubblor, utan också av mentala algoritmer, som till exempel bekräftelsejäv. Kanske för övrigt är en av förklaringarna till att regeringsbildningen tog så lång tid. För på båda sidor satt ju folk som inte kunde förstå hur den andra sidan tänkte. Och som kanske förlyssnar allt för mycket på hejaropen i de egna filterbubblorna istället för att förstå de andra partiernas perspektiv och politik. När man skriver en bok är man alltid rädd för att det ämnet man skriver om ska visa sig inaktuellt när boken kommer ut. Ja, eller så är det i alla fall för mig. Och jag brukar försöka beskriva ämnet i ett större sammanhang för att motverka det. Och när jag började undersöka hur tekniken påverkar vår världsbild för några år sedan, ja, då bestämde jag för att skriva liksom både om de här tekniska filtren och de mentala filtren som vi människor använder oss av. För jag kände att det redan då att det borde vara naivt att tro att vi människor är objektiva och allting är teknikens fel. Internet är inte alls trasigt utan det funkar precis som vi har programmerat det. Men däremot är det bekvämt att säga att internet är trasigt istället för att säga att vår egen omdömesförmåga inte riktigt funkar som den ska. Alla ser ju saker ur sitt perspektiv och utifrån sina erfarenheter och befinner sig därför samtidigt i individuella bubblor och andras bubblor, större bubblor där man delar värderingar med andra. Och man gör det här samtidigt. Så att jag är både stolt och glad över att boken som blev ett resultat av det här arbetet, den heter just Den stora bubblan och att den fick fin kritik för att den just tar det här bredare perspektivet. Och sist i den här podden får du faktiskt en bonus i form av ett smakprov ur min bok. Och Den stora bubblan hittar du för övrigt och du brukar strömma böcker som e-bok och förstås som vanlig hedlig tryckt version. Hur som helst, en av de där grejerna jag upptäckte när jag skrev den här boken, det är hemligheten för att ta sig in i någon annans bubbla. Det är att försöka kartlägga någons politiska åsikter och värderingar. Exempelvis genom att göra vad man kallar för en psykometrisk analys. Så om jag hade låtit dig svara på några enkla frågor i ett quiz på Facebook av typen vilken karaktär är du mest lik i Game of Thrones? Och så började jag också att ge mig tillgång till en profilbild för att kunna jämföra med de andra karaktärerna. Ja, då kan jag nämligen i bakgrunden ta en del av all möjlig information om dig. Det kan skrapa från din profil. Och det kan jag sedan använda för att dra olika slutsatser om vem du är och så här. Och det är skrämmande träffsäkert för övrigt när man jämför det med. Det finns mycket forskning på det här. Så att grejen är, det här är inte science fiction. Det funkar idag, eller det har funkat några år. Den här insikten, eller rädslan om man så vill, för hur mycket privat information vi egentligen lämnar ut i sociala medier och vad sen då andra gör med den för sin vinningsskull. Det kan man väl säga var en av de här frågorna som dominerar diskussionen kring sociala medier, och då särskilt Facebook, under hela 2018. Och att det blev så berodde på ett avslöjande. Ett avslöjande som tidningarna The Guardian, New York Times gjorde tillsammans med en tv-station som heter Channel 4 i Storbritannien våren 2018. Det var då det blev känt att det här kallas för Cambridge Analytica-skandalen och det blev då känt hur de hade jobbat med både Donald Trump och Brexit-kampanjen för att använda den här psykometriska analysen att kartlägga opinionen, kartlägga hur folk tänker och sen påverka olika delar av dem med riktad reklam i en önskad riktning då. Men det här avslöjandet hade nog kanske inte kunnat skett om det inte varit för en kille som heter Christopher Wiley, en programmerare som utvecklade mycket av tekniken bakom men som senare ångrar sig och börjar berätta vad han egentligen visste om hur Cambridge Analytica jobbade och mycket tillgång till information de hade för en journalist. Så Christopher Wiley vet mer än de flesta hur den här typen av kartläggningar går till, alltså rent praktiskt. Och efter avslöjandet förra året har han blivit en av nätets främsta tänkare och kritiker till hur lättvinnigt vi och stora företag och sociala medieföretag för den delen hanterar vår privata information. Och det är därför jag känner att jag vill prata med just honom om det här ämnet. Hur tekniken påverkar vår världsbild och därmed också hela samhället. Och innan vi börjar så vill jag tacka Mondial förlag som gett ut min bok Den stora bubblan. Jag vill tacka Fotografiska Studio Live som är en livescen mitt i Stockholm för musik, konst, litteratur och då poddinspelningar som den här. Och Elchim Yilmaz som producerar hela evenemanget. Jag ska också säga att Chris är både lätt och svår att intervjua. Och jag funderar ganska mycket på hur ofta jag ska avbryta när vi satt och pratade. Nu lät jag honom prata på ganska mycket medan jag bokstavligt talat satt och drack champagne och åt lite chips i bakgrunden. Och särskilt i början, eftersom det han har att berätta är så intressant. Så lyssna på en sann historieberättare som först ger dig sin historia från början till slut och därmed faktiskt också delade med sig detaljer av det här som han inte talat om tidigare. Och sen tillsammans med mig reflekterar du lite grann hur tekniken formar vår världsbild. Och som alltid, om du gillar den här podden, berätta om den för en vän. Sånt hjälper till att sprida den. Med det sagt, här är Christopher Wiley. Hej!
Hej!
Which is
my one Swedish word.
Yes. So
oh, no, I can say two. Hey, hey.
Hey, hey. Yes, yeah. That's true.
Extra Swedish.
So you have sandwich, we have snacks, we have champagne. This is supposed to be the British Queen, her favorite.
It is what the Queen drinks. And that's not just me.
Does she? Are you on like some kind of Queen diet here? No.
If this is a Queen diet, then great.
How has this last year been for you?
It has been bizarre. I think it's the bizarre and amazing and scary and lots of adjectives that I could probably continue to add on to that. Going from trying to keep everything quiet and constantly focusing on keeping things quiet until an investigation, you know, is at a point where the authorities have enough information or journalists have enough information and constantly being vigilant about, you know, who knows what and all that, to boom, you're on the front cover of, you know, two of the largest newspapers in the world and the media descends on you. And then the drastic difference from total quiet to being out there, it's quite a thing. It's hard to describe.
So you sort of came out in March last year.
So to speak.
When did you...
Used to it.
When did you actually blow the whistle? How long was that sort of the period?
I kind of hate the expression blowing the whistle because, like, it's not... You know, it's very rare that there's just, like, a moment that you've gone, you know, I can't actually whistle, so pretend I just whistled. You know, where you actually, quote, blow a whistle or you say, you know, look at this because... You know, in my case, and I know with several other quote-unquote whistleblowers, this has also been the case where it's sort of a process. You start to talk, you start to share information, you then, you know, possibly either work with journalists or work with, you know, police investigators. In my case, it was both. Over the process of, you know, in my case, a year, and even before that, trying to get people to pay attention to something that they weren't really paying attention to until, you know, Trump got elected. So for me, it was quite a long process. So I guess it was a slow, I don't know, massaging of a whistle or like a gentle breeze through that whistle until it got louder and louder and louder.
So there wasn't a specific tipping point or anything where you said that, okay, now,
I mean,
damn it.
You know, I think one of the things that I tried to explain to people is like, you know, when I first started, you know, I'd prior to Cambridge Analytica, I'd worked in progressive politics throughout my entire life. I'm a very progressive-minded person. And, you know, when I first started, it was a company called SCL Group, which was a British military contractor. And essentially, after working for years in Canadian politics and governments and the British government, you know, I got offered a position to work in a national security context, which I thought was really interesting because at the time, DARPA, which is the US military's research agency, and DSTL, which is the British version.
DARPA, who invented the internet, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, lots of people apparently invented the internet. But yeah, one of the contributors to the internet. But when the Western militaries started realizing that, you know, constantly spending money on, you know, missiles and tanks and all that actually isn't necessarily keeping people safe, because when you look at modern security threats like ISIS, you know, these are people that wage a lot of their wars through cultural narratives, and, you know, that happens online. And the military is not good at understanding technology, frankly, because, you know, I can't actually work in the army, right? So, you know, and if you're a really talented, you know, engineer or data scientist, you go and work at Google because you can have, you know, neon hair and nose rings and whatever. You don't work in the army, even though that's the kind of talent that the military needs for national security. So instead, they spend lots of money doing R&D projects with companies like the one that I worked at, trying to understand how we can use data, you know, through social media and the internet to identify potential security risks, you know, whether it's a recruiter, somebody who's potentially prone to, you know, join some kind of extremist group, and then stage interventions with that knowledge, whether that's a physical intervention or whether that's an informational intervention. Essentially,
would that still be considered as defense, or would that be?
You know, when we, depending on the project, the company worked on both defensive and offensive operations. Yep. Like I, you know, don't hide the fact I did weapons research. That's what I did. You know, in military doctrine, you have sort of a distinction between what you call kinetic weaponry. So that's like ballistics and explosives, where you deny, you know, your opponent through physical or kinetic force. And then you have something called non-kinetic weaponry, where you deny the objective of your opponent through non-kinetic force. So that can be cyber, where you, you know, maybe use hacking or some kind of, you know, computational approach, information or psychological approaches, you know, where you mislead or exploit some vulnerability in their thinking process, or economic, where you deny them access to their bank account or things like that, where, you know, and that, those, you can build weaponry. And when you think about, you know, what sort of makes up a weapon, you have sort of two fundamental components, right? You've got a payload. So, you know, in a missile, that might be an explosive. And then you have a targeting system. And in non-kinetic approaches or informational warfare, your targeting system is an algorithm that uses data. And your payload delivery is information and cultural narratives.
So the structure of the weapon remains sort of the same.
It's a weapon. It's just, it doesn't blow you up. It just confuses you. It misleads you. It, you know, if we're looking at a sort of psychological approach, you know, or it might, you know, screw up your system so you can't actually, you know, use your computer, right? And one of the things that we started, you know, looking at is like, what, how can we use this data, this social media data, to start to really intricately understand certain target profiles? And one of our clients in the U.S. Air Force Cyber Command just happened to be on a plane, you know, flying in the United States, and how Americans do, they just chat with people around them. And the person that they were sitting beside was a political operative, a very sort of alt-right kind of person, or, you know, what we now call alt-right, then called the Tea Party. And so they just chatted about, you know, what do you do, you know? And at the end of that plane ride, our client gave my boss's cards to this political operative who happened to be somebody who works for Steve Bannon. And then Steve Bannon came into sort of, you know, we sort of found ourselves in the targets of Steve. And at the time, he was just like, this is before he was quote-unquote Steve Bannon, like the Steve Bannon. This is when he was just Steve Bannon, weird guy who runs this site called Breitbart. And when...
the good old days.
In the good old days, we had President Obama, if you can remember that. And when Andrew Breitbart, founded Breitbart, before he died and then Steve took over, he always said that politics exists downstream from culture. So if you want to make any change, focus on changing the culture, and politics will just flow from that. So Breitbart was created to be this big sort of big idea culture change type thing. It turned out to be a website that sort of, you know, was a hate blog for straight white dudes who can't get laid. And I say that, like, that's, I don't even say that
flippantly. You say that with data.
I say that with data. I mean, you know, if you haven't already, look up incels or involuntary celibates, which is what the alt-right calls straight white dudes who can't get laid, and therefore they hate women. And this is like an actual thing. I'm not exaggerating, this was a big part of the alt-right, guys who can't get laid. And so one of the problems with Breitbart is that it wasn't making the impact that, you know, it was envisioned to make. And so Steve, when he took over, and he wanted to fight this culture war, this war in culture, you know, he realized that he needed to expand his arsenal of weaponry. And like I was saying before, when you fighting a war, you need an arsenal, and you start to think, what are those? What is that arsenal? And so when he discovered that there were companies that the military uses to do psychological operations or information operations, he's like, bingo, that's what I need. The problem was that we couldn't necessarily sell stuff because we were doing research for the military. So in the same way that, you know, if I'm making some new nuclear weapon, I can't just Joe come along and go, hey, I'd like to buy your nukes. And it's like, all right, here you go. You can't do that. So to sort of get around that, what happened was he being Steve, got one of his super alt-right pals, who happens to be a billionaire, a guy by the name of Robert Mercer, who made all of his money in, you know, becoming one of the first hedge funds that used algorithms in the 90s, PhD in computational linguistics. So he got all this data stuff to just go and acquire the company. And then what happened was, so we're working in this defense context, and then our management changes, our board changes, our shareholders change, everything changes. All of a sudden, this guy, Steve from America, is now like boss Steve. He's the boss man. And very soon after that, that's when, you know, the data that we were looking at that got, you know, accessed in by a team in Russia, Russians started coming in. We had all kinds of people getting put into the company that then wanted to start exploiting the research that we were doing with Americans. The people that we were setting out to defend became the targets. It wasn't just me. Like, a lot of people found that really problematic. The problem was that when you're, like, working in a company and all of a sudden, like, it gets bought and, like, it's starting to do criminal things, it's like you can't go to, like, HR and be like, can I, like, file, like, a complaint against the entire company for being criminal? Like, I'd like it on my, like, HR review that I dispute this. Yeah. You know, you can, you don't, you know.
Where's the HR department on Death Star?
Yeah. It's like, yeah. You are on the Death Star, and you know, if you don't like Darth Vader and you go to HR, you know, you're going to get shot into the, you know, the vacuum of space, right? That's your resolution to the problem. You won't care about this again because you'll be floating in space. And so what happened was, kind of like that, getting ejected from the company and then getting sued for like eons constantly over random bullshit because when I left and then several other people left, they then kind of freaked out that I was going to, you know, report them, which I did. The problem is, when you're in Britain, like, you want to report some kind of crime or whatever, you have to go to the local, like, police station. Like, so it's like the same whether somebody stole some gum from you or, like, you know, just like, you know,
I have a cat in the tree. That's where you end up.
You have a cat. Yeah. And so, you know, you go and you're like, all right, so hi, random policeman.
I fucked up the internet. So
it's like, all right, where do I begin? So we were like this military contractor, and then like this like super right wing guy got this like billionaire to buy us, and then like we were doing like this psychological warfare stuff with like ISIS, but now they're trying to do it in America, and then they like moved all the data to St. Petersburg in Russia, and I'm pretty sure like there's all these like security service agents,
and it sounds and, like you just sort of cut down a bit on the
like,
asset kit.
And it's like, all right, well, on the forum I'll check other. For the crime, and we'll file this and get back to you, right? And so, and you know,
and they would ask you not to smoke as much weed the next time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, the problem was that everybody that I talked to, you know, I talked to people who at the time worked in the White House, and the response was, "Well, of course, Donald Trump's like campaign team is shady. Like, he's a shady motherfucker. Like, he's a, you know, of course he's using. And yeah, sure, he's probably working with the Russians. That makes sense. We know that too. But Hillary Clinton's going to win, so we don't really want to see like seem like we're pushing the, you know, we're interfering with the election. God forbid somebody interfered with the election. And it was only after, you know, after Trump got elected that people started getting interested in this weird, shady kind of company. And it was actually The Guardian investigating Brexit, which is how they found me, because in Brexit, there was this random company based on an island on the west coast of Canada called AIQ. And its website was just a phone number, and which went to an answering machine. And 40%, over 40% of Vote Leave spending, the official Leave campaign, went to this random company. And no one in Britain had heard of it, and they were trying to figure out, what is this like company? When you Google its address, it's like a random house on this island on the west coast of Canada. That seems shady.
So a phone answering machine on a Canadian island spends 40% of the Leave campaign budget.
Yeah, and that seems odd.
I agree, yeah.
But they couldn't find anything out about this company because like, there was just nothing. And somebody at the Guardian just had the brilliant idea of just copying and pasting the number into Google, just like Googling the phone number. And what they found was the phone number was also the Canadian office of STL Group, this military contractor. And they're like, oh, that's weird. There's a British military contractor that has the same phone number in Canada as AIQ. And then so then they start looking into what is this STL Group, and they're like, oh, wait, it's Cambridge Analytica. Oh, wait, maybe that's not legal, because also Leave EU is using Cambridge Analytica officially, then the Vote Leave campaign was using something that was part of Cambridge Analytica.
But is it still The Guardian to do, is it?
Was it The Guardian? So then they, so anyway, they start investigating, and everybody's
how come no British agency says who's funding these campaigns, some official agency?
Girl, you assume competence, you assume people care. You seem people know
what they're doing. Go on.
Also, by the way, just as an FYI, in most countries, when you file for financial expenditures in an election, it's like 6 months after the election is finished, or the referendum in this case, right? So the attitude of the campaign was, meh, the referendum will be over by the time people find out, so whatever. Oh. And also, it was hidden quite elegantly, where it was actually very difficult to unpack. Anyways, they talked to all these people, and they're like, oh, you need to talk to Chris. Like, he knows about that. Anyway, so finally they found me, and I was like, girl, you don't know the half of it. Like, it's not just like, this American company that was actually like working on both sides of the campaign. It's like, it goes so much deeper. There's like fucking Russians involved, like intelligence agencies, Palantir, this like company that was founded by the CIA that does all this like spying shit, like all the, and they're like, what? And like, I'm like, yeah. And like, here's the docs.
Yeah.
Because girl's got her receipts. So then they started looking into it, and they're like, oh my God, this is like going into weird intel directions, like the Russians. There's like all these like things. It goes to Africa. They hacked like the president of Nigeria. Like, and there's like all these like security agents everywhere.
So you can imagine them doing one of those war rooms, sort of pinpointing everything.
Oh, literally, it looked like a crazy person's room. Like, yeah. you know, in like, you know, it's sort of a Beautiful Mind type thing where it's just sort of like there's lots of things connecting to lots of things, and you look in and you're like, all right, like, good luck with that. And so they brought in the New York Times. The New York Times is like, looks through the stuff, and they're like, all right, well, we validated this, but this still sounds fucking cray. And so that's when we brought on Channel 4 News, which is the other like lesser known but super cool public broadcaster in Britain that does sort of all the like quote unquote diversity edgy stuff that BBC doesn't do. And they do really good undercover operations. So then we planned, because essentially we were like, all right, this sounds like a really shit James Bond novel that you kind of probably don't want to watch, but like it sounds vaguely interesting. But we need to like...
We need to validate. I mean, as a journalist, to, like, I feel that...
It was validated, but it was validated in fucking emails. Like the emails or like contracts, and it's just like, it still doesn't... Like there's signatures and shit, like... It's all there, but it still sounded crazy. So we then planned out this like undercover operation where we just let executives at Cambridge Analytica, you know, tell us what they do, and then they set it all on camera. It was at that point, and you know, the authorities knew that we were doing this.
And were you part of that team, sort of planning?
Yeah, we're planning the whole thing out. Yeah. Whole thing out. It's crazy when you're planning. Like, you have to like plan out, like, you know, like the waiters have cameras, the food on the other table is a camera, like the sandwich could be a camera. I don't know. You know, you could put a camera
in
there.
By the way,
you'd be amazed at what you can put cameras in. Like, my favorite one was because we got this Saudi company that apparently that's a big market for hidden cameras, and they had this like Starbucks cup, and it literally just looks like a Starbucks cup, and you could actually drink out of it, like you could drink coffee out of it, but it was a camera. Like, it was literally a camera, and it looked like, I was like, what, that's a camera? And he took off the lid, and he showed me the camera on the inside. I'm like, I was drinking out of that. He's like, yeah, but it was a camera. Anyway, so we got all of this stuff. The authorities know this. They start planning on making a move on Cambridge Analytica, but then Facebook finds out, because we wanted to give Facebook extra time to respond to all the stuff that happened, because they authorized the application. You know, there was at least 87 million records of voters that were taken. That all went to Russia. In St. Petersburg, the team that was looking at that was also working for the Russian government. Yep. They were doing profiling work. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. And so then Facebook's like, the first thing that they do is they send a letter to The Guardian being like, we're going to sue you for defamation. Like, fuck the fuck off. And then they sent a letter to me because they're like, none of this is true. How dare you? Then same day, same lawyer sends me a letter going, all of this is true, but we're going to report you. And they didn't really think that, like, maybe I might walk over to The Guardian and be like, hey, Jill, who's the head lawyer, hey, Jill, did you get a letter today from Facebook? And she's like, yeah, I did, and they're really angry. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I got one too. Do you want to share? And she's like, okay. So we shared, and it was literally like, this is not true. This is all true. So obviously, you can't be entirely untrue.
Why did they tell you it's true? What's the point?
Well, so because they were threatening to take me to the FBI.
Yeah.
Now, they didn't realize that actually they were the subject of investigation. They were already under investigation by the authorities, and I was the primary witness in that. And then they just lied to The Guardian and said none of it's true. Now, when the CTO at the British Parliament was asked, why did you tell The Guardian that none of this was true and then start to take them to court, his response was, we just assume that's how we treat journalists, that we just threaten them with false allegations and hope that they stop publishing. And he was like, yeah, that's our bad. Sorry, we'll try better. So then my lawyers, who are brilliant, by the way, everybody involved in this story is like a woman except for me when I'm not a queen. And because women are awesome and they like, you know, don't mansplain shit and want to learn stuff. And anyway, so my lawyers, who are awesome, they call up Facebook. Like, so you want to report our clients to like the FBI? Have fun with that. By the way, you're actually the one under investigation. Then we get this letter from Facebook that's like, oh, so we sent you a form letter and we didn't appreciate the circumstances and we probably should have, quote, adjusted for tone and all that, you know. It's like, oh, sorry. We didn't mean to threaten you with jail time.
Or we should have threatened you with jail time, but in a nicer tone.
Yeah. We should have gently implied soft jail.
Which would be completely
gentle
cool.
Jail.
Gentle
you know, it's
jail.
Like the handcuffs with the fur on them.
That's one, yeah.
And so, anyway.
So here's a new letter.
Yeah. So then they're like, oopsies. And so then the general counsel of Facebook, which is like the head lawyery dude of the company, gets involved because then it goes to like board level of Facebook and they start panicking or whatever. Anyway, long story short, they don't actually like want our help, because we were just like, do you want to, like, we're happy to tell you about the story. This is why, like, we gave you all this time. Like, do you want to talk about it? Because, you're clearly really important in this. And then they just, like, stopped communications for a couple days. And then, anyway, on a Friday, the Friday before the story came out, so I go to bed, and I get this, like, phone call. It's, like, at 3 a.m., and I'm looking, and it's, like, New York Times, and I just, like, go hang up, like, don't answer, because, like, Americans sometimes don't quite understand that the world has different time zones, right? No. It's like, yeah.
They're bad.
Yeah. And but then it just keeps ringing. I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, oh my God. Anyway, so I pick up and I'm like, girl, it is 3 a.m. You woke me up. Like, call me later. Matt Rosenberg, who's one of the national security correspondents for New York Times, he's just a really, like, gruff but lovable guy. Like, and he's big and he, like, spent lots of years in Afghanistan, has all these, like, war stories about when he was in Afghanistan.
And now you're calling him girl.
And,
yeah.
And I call everyone girl. If I like you, I'll call you girl. And he's like, oh, and he's like, and I'm like, not understanding what he's saying. He's like, super angry. And I'm like, dude, like, take a chill pill or whatever. It's like, just, and he's like, do you see what Facebook did? I'm like, no, I didn't see what Facebook did. It's like fucking 3 a.m. I'm literally in bed. Literally, it's pitch black. And I'm lying in bed, like, in my underwear, just like, talking to the New York Times, and I hear people yelling in the background. And he's like, they're trying to fuck the whole thing. And I'm like, what? Anyway, so I go, and then I see, like, I'm banned on Facebook. And I was like, lol, well, okay, fine. I don't really use Facebook, but okay, cool, I'm banned. And then they try to leak the story, or rather, a very particularly misleading aspect of the story to some of the competitors to New York Times and Guardian. Because I guess they thought that that was a good idea. And so anyway, so he's super mad. And then it's like, well, I don't know like what to do. You should probably call the Guardian or whatever. Like, I'm not in charge. I'm just the guy who said stuff, right? So they then proceed to wake up all the editors of the Guardian at 3 a.m. to walk into the Guardian to change the newspaper. And then they also had to call Channel 4. Now, Channel 4 is responsible in the UK for broadcasting the Paralympics. So Channel 4 then had to get permission to cancel the Paralympics to move the story to that day and do that at, you know, like 4 a.m. And try to explain, you know, like, we need to cancel.
So you screwed up the internet and the Paralympics.
So yeah. So anyway, so long story short, if you want to piss off everyone in the global media, do that. That's a great strategy. If that's your objective, do that. Later that day, then some of the members of parliament who I was working with on the parliamentary side of the inquiry, they found out, they were super pissed off. Like, the idea that this company can just unilaterally ban a whistleblower. So then they called an emergency debate on Monday at Parliament. So then there was a debate about my ban. So literally, like, I'm watching, like, questions in Parliament about me being banned by Facebook, and then the Secretary of State responsible standing up on behalf of Her Majesty's government, issuing a statement saying what Facebook has done is, quote, outrageous. And that it's outrageous because what happened was, so my Facebook stopped working, obviously, but then, like, I didn't really care. I was like, okay, whatever. Like, I don't barely even fucking use Facebook. Like, whatever. But then I tried to go on Instagram because, you know, I needed my daily dose of, you know, well curated avocado toast and thirst pics of abs and hot people. And then that didn't work. And I was like, oh, weird. And then I'm like, oh, right, because they own Instagram. Oh, yeah. And then my WhatsApp didn't work. And then I tried to go on Tinder. But because I used single sign-on with Facebook, my Tinder stopped working, so I deleted all my dates.
And now, it's getting, really, and now it's getting painful.
Then it was, like, painful. Yeah. And then all my apps stopped working. And then I was like, what? I literally don't exist anymore. Like, it's crazy. I got deleted. Literally deleted. And then when my friends tried to look up, like, old, like, combos on, like, Facebook chat and stuff, it just, like, nothing, it just, I was gone. Like, it's not even my old chats. It's just, like, I literally was eviscerated. And what was so sort of offensive about that, and this was sort of discussed at Parliament, was like, a company without any due process can exert this amount of power so intimately on someone's life. And what happens, and if this is what they're allowed to do right now, what happens if they decide to exert that force in a broader sense? That's potentially dangerous, that we allow a company to have that right. And so anyway,
this is a perfect bridge to my question. So you'll have a bit of the Queen's champagne, and I'll talk for a second.
I'll drink some of the Queen's champagne.
To me, it seems like we today, as a society, have this uncertain relationship with personal data, let's call it that. We know there's a lot of data available about each and every one of us, but we're having trouble understanding what that really means. And my theory is that we only consider them on a piece of a piece by piece level, sort of that I might submit my name or my zip code, my MasterCard number and whatnot. And they don't seem to contain that much information all by themselves, these pieces. Yeah. But then when you combine them, they might say a whole lot about you. And to try to use an analogy here, it's like we would consider each piece of furniture in a room, but would not get the idea that together they will tell a lot about us. So this
an aesthetic and concept, if you will.
Exactly. So that abstract data might have a very tangible impact on yeah. your life when combined. Mm. Is that how you would describe it as well?
So, like, imagine for a second we're going on a blind date. All right. So, lucky you. I don't know how we met because my Tinder doesn't work. So, anyway.
Data blind date.
Yeah, we're doing some kind of old school whatever.
Yeah.
Cheers. Yes, cheers. yes. Yeah. Oh, you've got my favorite champagne. Look at that. You know so much.
I had someone tell you that's your favorite champagne. Yeah.
So, anyway, so now, okay, now we're going on a blind date. You don't know anything about me. You don't know who I am, okay? You don't know my name. You've never seen me before. We sit down, right? Okay, let's say for a second that we're on a blind date and like actually I know everything about you. I have access to your playlist. I know what you're listening to on your, you know, taxi ride to the restaurant. I listen to all your conversations with your friends, with your parents, with your ex. I read all your text messages. I looked at, you know, what school you went to, what grades you got. Everything. I know everything about you, right?
I would probably be flattered because that's who I am.
Great. Now, you don't know anything about me, right? And so what are the questions that you ask on a first date? It's usually like, you know, what kind of music do you listen to? Or like, what movies do you like? Do you play any sports? Seemingly innocuous questions, but these are questions that help us build the profile of who you are. If I go, oh yeah, I like the following bands in this sequential order, and I like these, you know, whatever films I like, you know, I play these sports, and you're like, wow, you're perfect. That's exactly what I do, right? You know, would you feel comfortable in that situation? Could you properly assess why am I saying this? Because in that situation, you don't necessarily know if I'm saying this because I'm being genuine or I'm saying this because I know what you want to hear. And the thing about online advertising is kind of like that situation where you don't even know how much I know, right? And like imagine we went on a date and you're like, oh wow, like this guy's perfect. He knows, like, he just loves everything that I love. And then I'm like, why don't you come back to my flat, right?
Yep.
Let's get a little bit more cozy, as Swedish people would say. You know, then there's a question of, are you consenting to that situation, right? Are you consenting to what I've told you? Or are you consenting to me? And so if you take online advertising, it is very much like that. In information operations, to get back to the military, what you call that situation is a situation of informational asymmetry.
Yep.
I can exert more influence and power over you because I have so much more information about you in my arsenal to use. You don't know anything about me. And when you think about a lot of, you know, online advertising networks or social platforms, like, they know lots about you. You don't know much about them. You don't know what they know about you. When you see stuff, you don't know necessarily why you're seeing that. And you go through the internet, and it seems kind of random, and it seems, you know, you don't necessarily see the intentionality behind it, but there is. And I think one of the problems is we don't ask questions about, you know, what are the ethics of doing that. My concern is when you look at, for example, all this like fucking bullshit about, like, you know, so you look at like the language that Silicon Valley uses, right? They talk about, you know, user experience rather than addictive design, right? They talk about your data, they call, like, you know, data exhaust or breadcrumbs, as if they're picking up waste products. Your identity, who you are, is a waste product that they're just recycling, right? And they have all these sort of words and euphemisms that I find really problematic because you look at, you know, Instagram or like any kind of social platform, really, and you look at the, like, you know, how the it's now swipey, right? You just continue to swipe, right? So there's this thing called ludic loops, which are the precursor to gambling addiction. So if you imagine a slot machine, right, doing this, where a repetitive task giving you an occasional reward can put you at risk of becoming addicted. And this is documented in addictions research. And you look at user experience, is what they call it, UX design, you know, and they measure engagement. What the fuck is engagement, right? It's you constantly using something. There's no innate good, but they always talk about it as if there's like this innate, you know, quality to engagement. The problem that I have is that when we look at the trends of where technology is going, and we look at all these little things and bits and pieces, as you're talking about, like the sort of, we're looking at the chair, we're looking at the sofa, but we're not looking at the big sort of picture. And, you know, we're now, you know, exploring self-driving cars. We're now putting Alexa into our homes. You know, we're now putting the sort of precursors to sort of systemic AI into our physical space. And what happens when all of these little pieces of furniture, so to speak, this AI, you know, where your living room watches you and thinks about you, and your refrigerator thinks about you, and your children's toys think about your kids and watch you watching your kids and start talking to your toilet, and your toilet talks to your car, and your car talks to the road, and the road talks to your boss, who's now a piece of AI, right? And they all start making decisions about you and for you, where you don't even, you're not even aware of what those decisions are, because you're inside of an ambient system that's constantly looking at you. And again, where it can see you, but you can't see it. It can make decisions about you, but you can't make decisions about it. No, and so the problem that I see is, like, what does it mean for, you know, making choices as a person, exercising your ability to make a free choice, when where for the first time in human history, the environment itself thinks about you, right? We talk about God, we talk about spirits, we talk about all kinds of things playing an influence on people's lives, but like we're literally about to create that.
And my problem with this is, to use your analogy, is that a lot of the programmers, such as yourself sometimes, talk about this like they are just architects of a casino, where they are they're just doing their job, and the job is to get people to stay in the casino with the slot machines as long as possible. And they sort of remove themselves from the bigger concepts.
And that's a real problem. I think that's a problem in education, but it really highlights the degree at which privilege plays a role in engineering and software architecture, because it's very easy for people to say, well, they decided to come into my casino, right? It's very easy to sit there as like a white dude who makes lots of money to say, well, they made a choice, they didn't have to do that, right? You know, and being able to sort of ignore the fact that, you know, the environment and society and your history exerts a huge amount of force on your ability to actually exercise choices. You know, you tell a job seeker, don't use LinkedIn if you want to, you know, or don't use Google. How can you get a job if you go to an employer and say, I'd really love this job, I'm super talented, we'll like do great work together, but I don't want to use any Google products because I want like to exercise my right to privacy, right? You're not going to get hired, right? So is that a real choice? Are you really opting in? So one of the problems, I think, within software engineering in general is like engineers are not taught to think about some of the dynamics and the forces at play when people make a quote-unquote choice. That's not actually a choice.
No, and also the fact that we talk about this as technology all the time, and something that is technology that can be fixed, and that is probably a technological solution that we're looking for. I think that one of the great myths we have dealing with is that sort of, oh, the internet is broken, oh, the social media isn't working the way we thought they would work.
So let's engineer it. Yeah.
Where in fact
it's very arrogant.
Yeah, where in fact where they work precisely the way we intended to. The algorithms are even better than we anticipated. And how do you fix something that isn't broken?
Yeah.
something I found fascinating is you coming from the fashion background,
yeah.
And sort of again referring back to Breitbart about sort of politics is downstream from culture,
yeah,
and how that affects people. And so I was thinking, when I mean, you the first time you met Steve Bannon, what did you make of how did you decode him?
Oh well, I mean, a hot mess, but not hot. So just a mess. So like he does this thing, and I didn't know why. I still don't really know why he sometimes wears multiple shirts at once.
Yep.
But not like in like a statement-y kind of way. And I forgot that when I wake up, I have to take off my old clothes kind of way, and I just put on. I keep compiling shirts until there's like, you know, an Elizabethan collar of sort of collars coming out the what, like literally he takes like Oxford shirts and puts several on top of each other. It was really weird, and then like you could see it collected dandruff. It was really gross. Anyway, but aside from that, when I first met him, he was literally, he was Steve from America. So like I know I, you know, one of the things that came to appreciate is like when you work at a military contractor, you meet some really fucking weird people. Like that's normal. So it's like some dude who's like called Steve from America, and you're like,
a normal weird guy.
You're like, yeah, and I'm like, all right, quote unquote Steve from America. You can ask me questions, and like I'll guess which agency you're actually from, and we'll play this weird game where you can't say what you're from, and you're assessing something or other. The questions that he asked were actually really interesting when I first met him. Like, what do you think culture is? Why do you think culture changes? Could you measure culture? And I was like, oh my God, this is like great. All right, girl, sit down. We're going to talk about culture. And like,
so was he the first one who understood you? I mean, because you two seemed like a very unlikely match.
I don't know if he understood me or whether he was just... I've come to appreciate I was a tool. So is that an understanding? Is that empathy? Is that just like psychopathy? Because it actually is classic psychopathy to look at you and go, you can be an extension of my will.
No.
I want you. I don't know. But we talked about one of the things that we talked about, as I said, like, well, you can look at culture in lots of different ways. One of the things that I find interesting is the fact that, you know, we use when you think about like describing different cultures or what people are like in different countries, right? And even if you indulge in a bit of, you know, light stereotyping and you go, what are Italians like compared to Germans, right? And you go, okay, maybe Italians are like more passionate or outgoing or extrovert or whatever, and Germans are more, you know, orderly and they plan and they're good at engineering and they make things like the Autobahn. Obviously, there's like Germans who don't fit within that, and there's Italians who don't fit within that. But kind of what you're describing is like, you know, a distribution. Generally, there's like people like this, and generally there's people like that. And that what I found interesting, and was one of the things that I was looking at when I told him, is I said, look, a lot of the same words that we use to describe cultures are the same words that we use to describe people. You know, you can almost personify Italy as a person. Because ultimately, culture is composed of people. So it's people behaving as people, and culture emerges from that. And that if people are in some way units of culture, whether they are the sole units or an aspect of units of culture, and we can measure people, and we know that we can measure people because the work that we were doing prior was looking at like the relationships between certain psychological facets of people and the data that they sort of spew out when they go about their business on the internet, that perhaps then culture can be quantified. And if you can quantify culture through the quantification of people, then actually your question about how do you change culture becomes one of pushing a distribution one way or the other. And when you push that distribution one way or the other, you can literally translate that deviation down to like actual lists of people who would fall within that necessary movement. Yep. And for him, that was, I think, quite eye-opening, because I think what happened was for the first time somebody kind of explains like, this is how you would do this culture change thing that you're interested in doing.
But you were also able to provide it to him by combining huge data sets that would say that if you like the Croc website, and you have ugly shoes, then you're probably a Trump supporter.
Yes.
Fairly simplified.
That's right? A very simplified version. I've said before, I look at Trump in the same way that I look at Crocs.
Yeah.
A mistake. But if you think about Crocs, you know, prior to Crocs being popular, they were ugly, right? And I say this knowing full well that I'm wearing ugly sneakers right now because they're on trend. But they were ugly, right? And so if you ask somebody in 1975 to wear Crocs, they'd be like, hell no, what the fuck is that? It looks like a fucking beach pail with holes in it. My toe might get cut off. Like, no. And then at some point, enough people experiment with this thing where they build up a critical mass, and then people start wearing it. Normal, regular people start wearing it and make this terrible aesthetic mistake where they're wearing something that's like a faux shoe. And then at some point, people come to their senses and realize this is stupid. They stop wearing it, and then they look back on photos of them wearing it, and they cringe and go, what the fuck was I wearing? I mean, how many times have people actually had that moment where you look back like 5 years, 10 years ago, and you're like, ooh, what was that? That was a mistake. And to me, Donald Trump is like that. He is, in the same way that the Croc is the mockery of what a shoe is, he is a mockery of what a president is. And at some point, people thought it would be a good idea to engage with this bullshit. And they will then have to look back and go, that was a mistake. That was stupid.
But still, the powerful thing about big data, if I understand you right here, is also the fact that you don't make that judgment when we combine big data set to say, okay, people like the Crocs and they like Trump. I don't know why and I don't care. Obviously, there's a connection here. That's why we use big data and big science, and then
yeah,
combine
but I think
and, like,
some of the power. So that's what you call black boxing it,
yeah.
Where it's like there's some relationships. There's also like a relationship between liking curly fries on Facebook and intelligence. It's true, but if you black box it, you're like, all right, you like curly fries, so you're clearly smarter, right? The reason actually is because the page was started by a Harvard professor. Who invited other Harvard professors, who invited like other professors. And so weirdly, this group, not because curly fries signal intelligence, but because of how the page got founded,
yep.
Attracted more intelligent people. Understanding that dynamic is actually quite important. One of the things before I left that I found really interesting when I started reviewing some of the footage of like focus groups or, you know, online panels and things like that, that they were doing with like these sort of straight white dudes who can't get laid, the incels, the involuntary celibates, was how they felt like they felt like they couldn't express or be who they were, and they sort of blamed feminism and all this kind of stuff for it. And one of the things that I realized is that when you look at, for example, I don't know if people have seen like a Tea Party rally, but like the flag of the Tea Party is this like flag that has like this snake on it, and it says "Don't tread on me," like "Don't get in my way." And then one of the things that I started to notice, and other people started to notice, because there's a lot of like gays working on the project before it got super alt-righty, was that these people were talking about how the feminists are making them feel closeted. And then you look at like a gay pride rally and you look at a Tea Party rally, and it's like a Tea Party rally is just the same message without the glitter. It's like, let me be who I want to be. Now, who you want to be is a disgusting person,
nope.
You know, and the reason you can't get laid is because like you're a terrible human being. Mm-mm. But the message is the same, and the feeling of being closeted is the same. And that's a very powerful feeling. And so I think one of the things that the company got right when they were doing research is to start to tap into like, oh, these highly privileged straight white dudes can't get laid. This makes them feel closeted. That makes them feel really angry. And they have all this pent-up anger, and that can be exploited.
Okay, I have two things here I wanted to say. First of all, I think that's a sort of a symbol of how we blame technology, because it's easier to blame technology, Facebook, Instagram, or whatever, rather than taking responsibility for ourselves, because we are in this confirmation bias filter bubbles,
yeah,
where we look upon the world. Sort of.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the progressives are, you know, there's a lot of fault on progressives.
Exactly. The filter bubbles did not help Trump win, but they can explain why so many people in the progressive didn't see it coming. Yeah.
Ignored people who genuinely need help. You know, the other thing that I really realize is that a lot of people who are racist, no one's born racist. Like, there's no like racist baby. It's not like, you know, like little Hitler babies like destined to like, you know, hate everyone. People in pain usually are the ones who are most hateful. And often that pain is, you know, I've been systemically unemployed, or I feel like I'm not living up to a particular promise or potential that I thought that I could. And one of the interesting things is like the number of times I've seen people who profess to be like people who wanted to stand up for, you know, people in bad situations, you know, people who are unemployed or people who don't have the same kinds of advantages that other people do, point fingers at people who don't have the privilege of education, who can't express themselves well, who don't have jobs, and go, look at these rednecks, look at these hicks. You know, I think that in the United States, Democrats did that. I think in Brexit, Remainers did that, where it's like, and they still do, it's, you know, these people, they don't know what they're talking about. Yep. So, like, you know, let's blame them. Not recognize that when you talk with fancy words with your Oxford degree, you are speaking with privilege.
Yep.
And not recognizing that your understanding of everything is a privilege.
And you can have the same here in Sweden, where we talk about the far-right Swedish Democrats from the progressive to talk about with the same kind of contempt, rather than trying to understand where they're coming from or trying to understand their pain sometimes. And I think that also...
And sometimes it's misplaced pain, but sitting, you know, having spent many conversations with abject racists and people who have really hateful views, and listening, and it's not easy to do, but listening with patience and being open and ironically creating a safe space, weirdly, to be racist, that you learn a lot. And that one of the things that I've learned is, like, progressives do not understand privilege. They really don't, because they recognize certain privileges and completely discount others. Education is one of them. You know, income is one of them. Class is one of them. Not speaking with a particular diction, not speaking with a complex understanding of the world, it is frowned upon, even though that is the only way you can do that is because you had the benefit of going to university and having an education.
Yeah, and that will come back to the second point I wanted to stress, and as I feel that also the automatic algorithm, they drive segregation, yes, on social media, but or they also reflect...
It is segregation, and that's, it's not just segmentation, it's segregation.
I think that segregation that we have online in social media and that's driving that is what we have the segregation offline. We are self-segregating.
Yeah.
We are staying in our neighborhoods.
I had so many conversations at Congress with these one-on-one conversations with members of Congress where, you know, they would say, what's the big deal? This is just about ads. I don't get it, right? And you talk to somebody, I won't name who it was, but this person was involved in the civil rights movement in the United States. And... you know, and he goes, I don't get it. It's just some ads. Why is this a big deal? And I said, well, why is it a big deal to sit on a bus? Why is it a big deal to use a water fountain? Why is it a big deal to go to a movie theater? There was an entire movement in the United States to desegregate, to put people in the same space. Segregation, one of the biggest faults of segregation, the biggest harms of segregation is that when you remove people from common space and common experience, that's when they become the other. And when somebody becomes the other, they, you know, are at risk of becoming not a person. And then it's very easy to, you know, commit atrocious harms. And that what we're doing online through personalization, through segmentation, is you know, we spent years trying to desegregate schools, desegregate public spaces, and now where people collect information, where people learn about what's happening in the world is being re-segmented and segregated. And the harm that could come from that, I think, is huge. Where if we no longer live in the same realities, and your reality is different from mine, we can't even have a conversation because we can't even agree on what's real. Like, I feel like there's a real harm that could come from that. And just because we might be on the same street together doesn't mean that we live in the same world together. And that's like, you know, a next level of segregation. All of the progress that has been made over the past 30 years in the United States, I feel like could be eroded because of this. And that's why we should care about it. That if you cared about segregation of schools or theaters, you should care about the segregation of the internet.
What would you say that you guys at Cambridge Analytica exploited, really? I mean, data is one thing, but there's something else here we're talking about. It's the exploitation of cultural narrative, of toxic masculinity, of...
Yeah. And empathy.
Feelings of shame, yeah, I mean...
Part of it was weaponized empathy, because...
What do you mean by that?
Well, empathy is the ability to understand how someone is feeling. Now, normally that's talked about in a good way. It's like you can understand somebody so you can relate to them better. But also, empathy allows you to manipulate in a more effective way. And so, you know, when you looked at...
Going back to that date, when you were exploiting your date.
Yes. And so, you know, when you looked at, for example, how Hillary Clinton's campaign team, they just used old data sets to anticipate turnout, looking at the past couple of elections for turnout, to estimate turnout, not ever asking the question, was the past couple of elections where Obama was president actually the exception to the rule, not the rule? And not actually going out to places like Michigan and talking to people, developing theories, then testing those theories. And I think CA was better
at... They misjudged Barack Obama for being the new normal, where in fact he was not.
They didn't... This is what I mean about like the arrogance of progressive people, is that it's like if you go in going, I own empathy, I own underprivileged people, I own all of these things, I understand it, therefore I am not going to test my assumptions, you're going to make mistakes. And you know, the thing that Cambridge Analytica did is that it went in trying to test things.
No.
And it got a much better feel of the American population than I think the Democrats did, because it wasn't arrogant.
So just because we have a...
Just because you want to help doesn't mean that you actually know what the fuck you're doing.
Just because we don't have a gay pride in Stockholm doesn't mean that we can sort of shelf the things about gay or LGBTQ rights. That's dumb.
Yeah. Well, and also just because you think of yourself as a, you know, well-meaning, well-rounded person doesn't mean that you're, you know, not... you know, discriminatory in other ways. One of the things that, you know, you notice about a lot of progressive people is they talk about underprivileged people, but then when you ask them, when was the last time you hung out with somebody that didn't have a university degree? When was the last time you talked with your cab driver? When was the last time you went to a council estate, you know, and talked to somebody on social welfare and hang out and like have a drink with them? Do you actually know these people that you profess to represent? Probably not.
And instead of seeing sort of the information asymmetry you're talking about, it's about information deficit. And so we're trying to get these people more
information. But it's the worst kind of information deficit, because it's the kind of information deficit where you don't know what you don't know. Right? It's not like there's an understanding of that gap. It's a super blind spot, because you don't even know what you don't know. Because you think you know it, but you don't.
Changing tracks slightly, after Cambridge Analytica, you've returned to the fashion bubble, applying your skills in combining big data to optimize your business. You're now at the H&M Group. Tell us what you do there.
We are looking at ways of engaging people. We're looking at ways of anticipating fashion trends. And what's really cool about that is that when you look at fast fashion and the amount of waste that exists in fast fashion, partly because there's a mismatch between supply and demand, that if we're able to better match our supply and our product without demands and reduce the amount of products that don't sell and get thrown out, we're able to make a dramatic impact on our carbon emissions, which is super cool. So, like, what's really neat about working with H&M is that we're able to, like, actually make an impact. Like, we're so big that we can actually make an impact on not only our environmental footprint, but also exert pressure on the rest of the industry to follow suit.
And they've always been very data conscious and data driven, right?
I mean, data, I think, for the fashion industry at large has come, so the sort of awareness of what you can do with it has come later than, say, like finance. But I know that the company is like really keen to take its what it currently knows about the market and try to apply it to make better things. And the really cool thing about fashion is, like, not only, you know, by reducing waste we can reduce, you know, carbon emissions and all that, but, like, I think people underestimate the power of, like, that sort of every morning people wake up and decide what to wear. And if we can make things that make people feel better about themselves and feel more confident, like, the sort of holistic impact that we can make on people, I think, is significant. Making people feel better about themselves is, like, a really cool task.
Yeah. But there could also be a bunch of buzzwords. How, I mean, how do you go about doing that in your sort of when you get to work tomorrow?
In terms of how do we understand what people want or how
what they want,
wear
and also
things,
how they feel better about themselves? Is it about providing them data that at the H&M Group we do this and this with sustainability, or is it about helping people? Are you involved in sort of designing stuff differently based on data? Or?
Yeah, I think also taking a different mindset to start with customers first, always start with people, and what is it that is going to, you know. And the other thing too is that it's not just, you know, asking a customer what do they want and then flogging it to them. It's looking at the entire journey of that product. Like, when they wear it, does it actually fit well? You know, people don't necessarily know enough about all the intricacies of clothing to better to say, like, exactly what it is that they want. They just want it to be right. Yep. And so start to look at, like, does it fit well? Does it last? Like, is this actually something that is going to make someone look good?
Yep.
And feel good? And the really cool thing that I find about this company is that, like, every single meeting that I have, are we helping people feel good? Are we helping people look good? And also, are we doing what we can to start to reduce our impacts on the environment? Comes up in every single meeting. Even if sustainability is not on the agenda, if people's, you know, well-being is not on the agenda, it comes up in every single meeting. And I really, that's a very unique attitude and internal culture that I haven't seen in other companies, which I mesh with well.
So you don't miss politics, given the fact that you sort of move more upstream?
I think that you can make as much of an impact, if not more, in fashion than in politics. Because you put on clothes every single day. Clothes represent things. Clothes are powerful. When you look at, you know, any kind of political movement, major political movement throughout history, you know, you can picture what, you know, a Maoist in you know, communist China looks like, or what a Nazi looks like, or what any kind of, what ISIS fighters look like. Clothing is a really powerful symbol. And so often, as the examples that I just gave, are things that end up harming people. But on the flip side, I think that we can use fashion to open up conversations with people and get people to start thinking about stuff as a vehicle of positive social change. So and H&M really does take its role in society seriously. Which I think is actually unique in the fashion sector,
and also in a peaceful way.
In a very peaceful way.
Thank you so much, Chris, for talking to me.
Cheers. Thank you for having me.
Det där var alltså Christopher Wiley som pratade med mig om hur tekniken påverkar vår världsbild. Det var inga boktips den här gången, men väl ett smakprov ur min bok Den stora bubblan, som du alldeles strax ska få höra. Boken finns i sin helhet där du strömmar böcker, som e-bok eller som tryckt upplaga. Och vill du läsa den på engelska så finns den faktiskt också på engelska. Då heter den The Big Bubble och finns på Kindle, iTunes, Amazon och överallt där du köper böcker utomlands. Producent för Perspektiv är Gabriella Lahti. Jag heter Per Granqvist och podden görs av WWW Media i samarbete med Acast. Nu blir det inledningen till boken Den stora bubblan.
Det är särskilt viktigt att vara välinformerad om man har makten att ge order om att fullständigt utplåna andra länder. Det är därför den amerikanska presidenten får flera mappar med viktiga och hemliga dokument tidigt varje morgon, oavsett var han befinner sig i världen. En av mapparna innehåller säkerhetstjänstens senaste analyser av frågor kopplat till nationell säkerhet och konflikt i världen. En annan mapp är fylld med underlag inför dagens möten, bakgrundsinformation om de man ska träffa och eventuella talepunkter. I en tredje mapp finns en sammanfattning av den allmänna opinionen och pressklipp som exemplifierar presidenten och de frågor han driver porträtteras i media för tillfället. Syftet med mappan är att ge presidenten en fullständig överblick över läget i nationen och utomlands baserat på robusta underlag så att han kan fatta välbalanserade beslut med nationens intresse för ögonen. Olika presidenter har förstås haft olika önskemål om vad som ska ingå i mapparna och hur ofta de ska presenteras. John F. Kennedy ville ha sina sammanfattningar kortfattade och i ett format som gjorde att han kunde ta med sig den viktigaste informationen i innerfickan. George Bush den yngre ville inte ha sammanfattningar på söndagar. Barack Obama ville ha mapparna och allt innehåll digitalt. Donald Trumps synpunkter gäller själva innehållet i pressmappen. Han vill nämligen bara ha positiva nyheter. Personal i Vita huset fick därför uppgift att sortera ut de mest positiva nyheter om presidenten och hans politik de kunde hitta i medieflödet. Uppgiften var att hitta 20-30 saker två gånger om dagen. Innehållet var en blandning av positiva omdömen från programledare på morgonprogrammen, beundrande tweets, artiklar där folk på gatan säger snälla saker om presidenten, uppskattande inlägg i sociala medier, hyllande intervjuer i högerpressen och ibland bilder på Trump där han ser kraftfull ut i ett tv-inslag. Dagar när det inte fanns tillräckligt med positiva nyheter hände det att medarbetarna gick runt i Vita huset och frågade efter fördelaktiga bilder på presidenten att inkludera i vad som internt kom att kallas för propagandamappen. Syftet med mappen var att hålla den välkänt koleriska och egocentriska presidenten på gott humör genom att tillåta honom att upprätthålla en felaktig bild av världen. Hur vet vi att den svenska statsministern är bättre informerad än den amerikanska presidenten? Är vi inte alla offer för de förutfattade meningar och fördomar vi har om oss själva och andra, och därmed även om hur världen fungerar? En socialdemokratisk politiker ser samhället genom ett helt annat filter än en borgerlig politiker och tolkar därför det hen ser på ett annorlunda sätt. Hur skaffar man sig en korrekt bild av världen? Ett sätt är att följa debatten och se vad olika aktörer tycker om aktuella frågor i samhället och försöka dra slutsatser av det. Om du är som jag, innebär det att du läser tidningen eller tittar i någon nyhetsapp på telefonen. Kanske scrollar igenom flödet på Twitter, förmodligen öppnar du Facebook. Men att man vet vad två olika aktörer tycker i en debatt innebär naturligtvis inte att man automatiskt kan avgöra vad som är sant. Om en person hävdar att klimatförändringarna på jorden beror på människan och en annan säger att klimatförändringarna är påhittade, ligger inte sanningen mitt emellan. Dessutom kan det vara så att det man ser i flödet på Twitter eller Facebook bara är ena sidan av en debatt. Kanske ser du bara de som hävdar att klimatförändringarna är påhittade. Kanske ser du bara nyheter som går ut på att allt snack om klimatförändringar är överdrivet eller en vänsterkonspiration. I en valrörelse blir det extra tydligt. Ideologiskt vinklade nyheter och anpassade annonser bekräftar det partisympatisörerna redan tror på och förstärker de fördomar man har om de politiska motståndarna. Socialdemokraterna säger att det var länge sedan Sverige var så välskött som nu, när de har styrt i 4 år. Moderaterna säger att det var länge sedan Sverige hade en så inkompetent regering som under de senaste åren. I beskrivningen av läget i Sverige tycks det inte finnas en enda sak som de kan enas om. Båda sidor förmedlar en bild av att den andra sidan överdriver och förfalskar. Genom historien har medierna varit de man kunnat lita på i tider när debatten varit polariserad. En viktig grundhållning inom journalistiken är opartiskheten. Det finns medier som står mer till höger eller mer till vänster i sitt förhållningssätt till världen och till makten. Men de delar likväl ett grundläggande förhållningssätt till hantverket. Även om en redaktion väljer en viss vinkel i en nyhetsartikel så undviker man att välja sida, bli partisk och framstå som en propagandamaskin för den ena eller andra sidan. Båda sidors åsikter i en konflikt ska rapporteras och läsarna, lyssnarna, tittarna ska alltid kunna lita på att fakta är korrekta. Genom att jämföra olika mediers rapportering av en händelse kan man alltså både avgöra om en nyhet är sann, flera rapporterar om samma sak oberoende av varandra, och få en djupare förståelse av vad som har hänt eftersom de varit lite olika vinklar. De senaste åren har dock förtroendet för media minskat och anklagelser om att media inte förmedlar en korrekt bild blivit vanligare. Media sägs undanhålla och tysta ner saker och ibland publicera sånt som inte alls är sant, så kallade fake news. Så hur vet man om det media skriver verkligen är sant? En viss vägledning kan man få genom att ta hänsyn till vem som publicerat nyheten. Aftonbladet är mer trovärdiga än Avpixlat. En del nyheter publiceras dock på sajter som till utseende är förväxlande lika nyhetskällor med hög trovärdighet, men som i själva verket bara är fejk. Kopior skapade för att lura oss besökare att tro på det ena eller det andra och sen sprida det. Fake news och falska sajter är något som främst förknippas med USA, men det finns i många länder och Sverige är inget undantag. Ett sätt att kontrollera något är, åtminstone i teorin, att kontrollera uppgifter mot ett uppslagsverk. Men hur många gör det? I praktiken googlar vi numera allt vi undrar över. Sökmotorer fungerar som bekant helt annorlunda än uppslagsverk. De resultat som visas när du söker är inte sorterade efter vad som är sant, utan efter vad som är relevant. Närmare bestämt vad andra som också sökt på samma fråga tycker är relevant. Om frågan är enkel, som vem som är president i USA just nu, är svaret ofta korrekt. Om svaren är mer komplicerad, som om Donald Trump anses vara en bra president, visas sällan några entydigt svar och det blir därför svårt att kolla om något är sant eller falskt. Det påstås dessutom ofta att Google anpassar sina sökresultat efter användaren, vilket gör arbetet med att kolla upp något ännu svårare, eftersom svaret beror på vem som söker. Om du är som jag, och väldigt många andra, får du en stor del av dina nyheter via Facebook. Varvat med uppdateringar från vänner och bekanta hittar man i flödet länkar till de nyheter som engagerar folk mest för tillfället. En gång i tiden var Facebook bara en sajt bland andra. Idag är det en politisk och kulturell kraft som påverkar hela världen. Och effekten av den förändringen blev uppenbar för många först i samband med det amerikanska presidentvalet 2016. När företagen som skapat de plattformar vi kallar för sociala medier talar om sina användare gör de ofta det med ett högtravande språk. De kallas medlemmar och beskrivs som delar av ett samhälle, ett digitalt community. När de först dök upp lovade de att erbjuda plattformar utan motstycke i historien. Ett forum där alla aktörer, medborgare, politiker, media, lobbyister, ideella organisationer och företag skulle kunna samlas och diskutera frågor som låg dem varmt om hjärtat. I denna nya publika sfär skulle ensamma själar kunna hitta själsfränder. Engagemang skulle kunna födas och frodas. Alla röster skulle kunna höras och delta i ett gemensamt samtal om saker som betyder något för dem. Det kändes som en ny sorts frihet och plattformen tycktes fungera så också. Men i själva verket var det aldrig något annat än ett kommersiellt förhållande. Företagen uppträdde som liberala demokratier och använde ett språk som påminner om demokratiska institutioner, trots att de enväldigt bestämde alla regler. Att företagen uppträdde som kvasistater kan låta cyniskt, men det var inte deras intention från början. Cynism är inte ett personlighetsdrag jag stött på särskilt ofta hos entreprenörer under de drygt 20 år jag följt utvecklingen av olika digitala tjänster på nära håll. En naiv tro på att digitaliseringen av samhället är ensidigt positiv för medborgarna, det är däremot vanligt. Användarna har förstås i många fall varit lika naiva. Under uppbyggnadsfasen dessa privatägda digitala samhällen har bilden av plattformarna som demokratiska verktyg tjänat företagen väl. Det är lättare för användaren att dela stora delar av sitt privata liv med ett företag som lever på att kapitalisera på användarnas data, om de tror att företaget är något mer. I takt med att de stora plattformarna på internet vuxit och därmed påverkat en allt större del av offentligheten har deras påverkan, både positiv och negativ, blivit tydlig. Nu för tiden är det meningslöst att dela upp verkligheten i en fysisk och en virtuell del. Digitalisering av vardagen har gjort att de båda delarna smält samman. Atomer och bits förekommer huller om buller. Digitaliseringen har gjort att det som förr var statiskt blivit plastiskt, ofta anpassat efter användaren. Intentionen är god. Den optimistiska synen på effekterna ofta mycket naiv. Till exempel, det låter behändigt med nyhetstjänster som är skräddarsydda efter användarnas preferenser, men effekten är samtidigt att det försämrar våra möjligheter att sätta samman en mental mapp med olika nyhetsklipp när vi vill skaffa oss en rättvisande bild av verkligheten. Vare sig vi vill det eller ej, formar tekniken numera vår världsbild. Algoritmer, filterbubblor och falska nyheter. För att skaffa oss ny kunskap måste vi förlita oss på andra som vet mer. Den mänskliga kunskapen är väsentligen social. Det gör att sannolikheten för att vi skaffar oss ny kunskap ökar ju fler människor vi har kontakt med. I ett historiskt perspektiv har allmänheten alltid tjänat på att så många som möjligt får utrymme att dela med sig av sina kunskaper. Baksidan med den demokratisering av det offentliga utrymmet som internet bidragit till är att det är svårt att avgöra vilka människor som besitter värdefull kunskap och vilka som förmedlar sånt som är felaktigt. För att hjälpa sina användare att sortera i det breda men fragmenterade informationsflödet använder sig Facebook, Instagram, Twitter och många andra aktörer av algoritmer. Algoritm är ett finare ord för en ekvation som tar hänsyn till en rad faktorer för att presentera ett visst resultat. När du scrollar genom ditt Facebookflöde hittar du inlägg från dina vänner till synes huller om buller. Men sammansättningen är i själva verket ett urval som gjorts av en algoritm som gissat vilket av alla inlägg dina vänner gjort som är mest relevant för dig. Många nyhetssajter gör som sagt samma sak och anpassar sina första sidor efter sina besökares preferenser. Algoritmen har lärt sig att jag inte är intresserad av sport. Jag klickar aldrig på länkar till sportartiklar. Och visar därför mycket sällan sportnyheter i mitt flöde. Däremot får jag då och då se artiklar kopplade till hästhoppning eftersom jag har en vän som är en duktig ryttare och jag uppenbarligen läser artiklar om honom. En annan förklaring är att de sociala mediernas algoritmer prioriterar inlägg kopplade till dem som vi har täta sociala relationer till. I sin iver att sätta samman flöden som är så relevanta som möjligt filtrerar algoritmerna bort allt som vi inte verkar gilla. Tills dess att vi bara omges av sånt som vi sannolikt kommer att tycka om. Effekten blir att vi hamnar i en stor filterbubbla där vi ser sånt vi redan tror på. Bubblan blir dessutom allt tätare med tiden eftersom algoritmerna förstärker sina egna antaganden om vad du gillar genom att bara visa dig sånt du gillar. Allt annat filtreras ju bort. Resultatet blir en ekokammare där bara en viss sorts åsikter kan höras. Att ha kunskap innebär, lite förenklat, att ha sanna, välgrundande övertygelser som vi kan basera vår världsbild på. Men ibland lurar vi oss själva. Om vi är övertygade om att något är sant tenderar vi att försöka bekräfta de egna övertygelserna. Fenomenet kallas för bekräftelsejäv, på engelska confirmation bias, och har varit känt inom psykologin i flera decennier. Istället för att utsätta våra övertygelser för kritisk granskning gör vi vad vi kan för att bekräfta dem. Bekräftelsejäv är alltså den mänskliga motsvarigheten till algoritmer och spelar en central roll i förståelse för människors förmåga att bilda sig en uppfattning om världen. En direkt parallell till algoritmernas förmåga att sätta samman flöden i sociala medier. I sociala medier uppstår därmed en olycklig förstärkningseffekt när mänskligt bekräftelsejäv möter algoritmerna. Effekten att bli ännu svårare att bilda sig en korrekt bild av verkligheten. Donald Trump har gjort sig känd för att kalla saker för falska nyheter när han för något som inte passar hans världsbild. En mapp med enbart positiva nyheter är en filterbubbla i det lilla formatet. Effekten är en välutvecklad faktaresistens, som i Trumps fall dock började utvecklas långt innan han blev president. Det är också ett exempel på, citat, politiskt motiverat tänkande, slutcitat, för att använda Dan Kahans begrepp. Kahan är professor i juridik och psykologi vid Yale-universitetet och har tillsammans med sina kollegor studerat tendensen att försöka bekräfta de åsikter som hör till den egna ideologiska och kulturella gruppen. Deras forskning visar att när en faktafråga är politiskt laddad baserar vi ofta våra övertygelser på känslor istället för på evidens. Genom sin vana att frekvent avsluta sina tweets med sad illustrerar Donald Trump fenomenet i praktiken. Resultatet av politiskt motiverat tänkande blir faktapolarisering. Vad vi tror om olika frågor blir en effekt av vårt politiska tänkande, inte av väl underbyggd kunskap. Det kan vara en förklaring till att den svenska debatten är så tråkig nu för tiden. Kombatanterna står mest och upprepar vad de tror och tycker och känner, ofta utan koppling till vad som är fakta. Bekräftelsejäv och politiskt motiverat tänkande skapar utmärkta förutsättningar för den som vill sprida falska nyheter. Genom att skapa rubriker som tycks bekräfta befintliga övertygelser får skapare av falska nyheter oss att klicka på länkar för att läsa mer, med förhoppningen om att få dessa övertygelser bekräftade. En av de mest kända exemplen på falska nyheter under den amerikanska presidentvalskampanjen 2016 handlade om att påve Franciscus ställde sig bakom Donald Trump som president. Mer än 1 miljon personer gillade och delade den falska artikeln. Jämför man det med de 20 populäraste nyheterna på Facebook om det amerikanska valet med de 20 populäraste falska nyheterna på Facebook under de 4 månader innan valdagen i november 2016, då blir det tydligt hur gärna vi vill få våra övertygelser bekräftade. Antalet reaktioner, gillningar, kommentarer på de falska nyheterna uppgick till 8,7 miljoner. Att jämföra med 7,3 miljoner för de sanna nyheterna. Det bakomliggande syftet med såväl sociala medier som alla andra digitala tjänster som erbjuder vad som en anglicism kallas för personalisering, det är att få användarna att använda tjänsterna så mycket som möjligt. Problemet är att användarna varken har insyn i eller kan påverka vilken vikt algoritmen lägger vid olika typer av personlig information och beteenden. Det finns ingen avstämningsknapp för algoritmen om jag exempelvis hade föredraget att se alla vänners inlägg i kronologisk ordning som det var från början. På senare år har algoritmerna börjat försöka inkludera saker som jag inte visste att jag gillade. Detta görs genom att jämföra min individuella profil med andra profiler som på något sätt liknar min och använda den informationen om det som de andra användarna gillar för att föreslå saker för mig. Enkelt uttryckt skapar algoritmen en stereotyp som den använder för att göra antaganden om vad jag borde gilla. Det är antagligen därför jag inte ser artiklar som handlar om yoga i mina flöden, trots att jag tycker om det. Men jag är ju man och den stereotypa yogautövaren är kvinna. Det är också ett tecken på att algoritmerna aldrig är helt neutrala. De fördomar och värderingar som finns hos dem som skapar algoritmerna påverkar koden. Ofta märker vi inte det, helt enkelt eftersom programmerarna inte heller tänker på det. Det finns alltså många samverkande faktorer som försvårar möjligheten att skapa sig en korrekt bild av världen. Lägg sedan till att medielandskapet är betydligt mer fragmenterat än för några decennier sedan. Det är lätt att förstå de som skyller utvecklingen på digitala medier i allmänhet och pekar på att sociala medier bidrar till en polariserad samhällsdebatt. En lösning som föreslaget är att man bör kräva att de sociala nätverken tar ansvar för vilken världsbild de presenterar för sina användare. Genom att ändra sina algoritmer skulle de kunna förhindra att filterbubblor bildas genom att föreslå nyheter som utmanar användarnas världsbild. Jag har flera invändningar mot ett sådant förslag. För det första utgår förslaget från antagandet att vår världsbild enbart formas av våra flöden i sociala medier. Som om vi aldrig bläddrar i en tidning, aldrig så nyheterna på tv, aldrig uppfattade något från nyheterna på radio eller lyssnade när vänner uttryckte åsikter om samtiden. Digitala medier kan inte ensamt belastas för att skapa filterbubblor. Väljer du att enbart läsa en viss typ av tidningar riskerar du också att fastna i en filterbubbla. För andra är sociala nätverk och plattformar inga demokratiska institutioner. När vi gick med godkände vi användarvillkor som tydligt stipulerar att vi varken kan utöva inflytande på hur tjänsten är utformad eller kräva plattformarna på ansvar för de oönskade effekter vi kan uppleva av regelbundet användande. För det tredje vänder jag mig mot idén att någon skulle diagnostisera mina flöden för att avgöra om min världsbild är balanserad och därefter medicinera mig till dess att min nyhetsdiet åter var balanserad. Jag förstår att intentionen är god, men lösningen är likväl befängd. Den fjärde invändningen är att poängtera det självklara. Alla försök att korrigera någons självbild mot dennes uttryckliga vilja går emot viktiga liberala idéer om individens självbestämmande. Mina vanföreställningar kanske saknar grund, men de är likväl mina. Under flera decennier har statens ansvar, och därmed möjligheten att bestämma över medborgarna, minskat i flera länder till förmån för ökade möjligheter för medborgarna att ta eget ansvar och fatta egna beslut. Idén om att företag plötsligt skulle ta ansvar för att säkerställa att användarna blir allmänbildade. Ett ansvar som närmast påminner om det ansvar europeiska välfärdsstater önskar ta på sig för medborgarna i mitten av 50-talet är lika otidsenlig som absurd. En femte invändning är att påminna om bekräftelsejävet, vår egen förmåga att, medvetet eller omedvetet, skapa filterbubblor genom att söka efter information som bekräftar vår egen världsbild. Även om algoritmerna skulle ge oss en balanserad nyhetsdiet skulle vi tillskriva de nyheter som bekräftar våra uppfattningar större betydelse än de som utmanar uppfattningarna. Likväl tycker jag mig förstå varför förslaget uppstått. När vi betraktar filterbubblor som en teknisk utmaning blir automatiskt tekniska lösningar vi söker och sätter vårt hopp till. Problemet är dock mer komplext än att det kan lösas genom att förändra några algoritmer. Problemet är vår oförmåga att ta ansvar för vår egen nyhetsdiet och vår okunskap om det nedärvda bekräftelsejävet. Effekten av detta blir att vi hamnar i en tät filterbubbla. Ska vi lösa problemet krävs folkbildning om att ansvaret för att filterbubblor uppstår vilar på var och en av oss. Inte på sociala medierna eller plattformarna, och absolut inte på staten, utan på dig och mig och alla andra som försöker skaffa sig en balanserad bild av världen. Lösningen är att folkbilda om detta ansvar och hjälpa folk att ta kontroll över sin informationsinhämtning och att utöva grundläggande källkritik. Insikten att man befinner sig i en stor bubbla av något slag är ett viktigt första steg. Bedrägliga filterbubblor. Kampanjorganisationerna hos både Donald Trump och Hillary Clinton var tydligt omedvetna om i vilken utsträckning filterbubblorna polariserat presidentvalet. Istället för en valkampanj där alla medborgare får ta del av kandidaternas argument i viktiga samhällsfrågor, vore det mer rättvist att beskriva Trumps och Clintons kampanjer som helt parallella tävlingar för att få så stor andel av de egna följarna att gå till vallokalerna att rösta. Båda sidor beskrev sin motståndare som mentalt instabil istället för att diskutera dennes förslag. Eller att fundera djupare över vilka argument som attraherade motståndarnas supportrar på kampanjmöten. Något liknande kunde vi se redan i det svenska riksdagsvalet 2014. I slutskedet av valrörelsen valde Miljöpartiet att lägga all kraft på att demonisera Sverigedemokraterna istället för att ta den oro för landets framtid som SD-väljarna kände på allvar. Alla som röstar ett val gör det för att valet känns logiskt för dem på något vis. Om man beskriver motståndaren som moraliskt korrupt i känslomässiga ordalag och dennes anhängare som ideologiska extremister, lågutbildade dumskallar eller som en självgod elit, då filtrerar man omedvetet bort möjligheten att försöka förstå hur deras världsbild ser ut. Det är ett exempel på det politiskt motiverande tänkande som jag nämnde tidigare. Känslorna påverkar alltså vår förmåga att göra en objektiv bedömning. Jag brukade tycka att jag hade ganska bra koll på amerikansk inrikespolitik. Ända sedan jag arbetade som volontär i Barack Obamas första presidentkampanj 2008 har jag följt politiken på avstånd med intresse och genom ett liberalt filter. Detta bekräftelsejäv gjorde att jag inte kunde förstå hur någon kunde tänka sig att rösta på Donald Trump. Fascinationen över min egen oförmåga födde en idé. Genom att manipulera Twitters algoritm för att föreslå konton som påminner om varandra kunde jag skapa två separata bubblor med republikanska respektive demokratiska Twitteranvändare. Det tillät mig att börja studera bubblorna inifrån och ta del av argumenten, som om jag vore en helt vanlig Trump- eller Clinton-anhängare. Till karaktären påminner bubblorna mycket om varandra. Var och en hade sina tongivande röster, sin beskärda del falska nyheter, sina högljudda supportrar och lojala medier som förlöjligade den andra kandidaten. I båda bubblorna var förvåningen stor över hur 17 av vettiga människor skulle kunna tänka sig att rösta på den andras bubblans idiotiska kandidat. Båda bubblorna tycktes ha segervittring. Ändå var förvåningen stor från båda sidor när valresultatet stod klart. Donald Trump borde förstås inte kunna vinna. Någon så politiskt oerfaren och med ett så fläckat rykte som fastighetsmiljonären från New York borde inte kunna vinna primärval. Borde inte kunna bli presidentkandidat. Borde inte kunna bli vald till president. I alla fall inte om man jämförde honom med tidigare kandidater och den granskning som de utsattes för innan de vann folkets förtroende. Filterbubblor räcker inte som förklaring till varför Donald Trump vann presidentvalet. Däremot kan filterbubblor förklara varför så många gissade fel, trots att det fanns signaler som indikerade att Clintons seger inte var självklar. När man endast ser saker som bekräftar den egna världsbilden kommer man oundvikligen att feltolka tecken som tyder på motsatsen. Ställd inför fakta och med krav på att kunna ge förklaringar till varför det blev så här, är det måhända ohederligt av en politisk expert att skylla på någon annan, men det är likväl mänskligt. Om man tror att man är objektiv gör bekräftelsejävet att man avfärdar idén om att man skulle kunna vara påverkad av bekräftelsejäv innan man ens hunnit tänka efter. Efter att folket oväntat röstat ja till Brexit i juni 2016 la många förståsigpåare således skulden till prognosfiaskot på undersökningsföretagens felaktiga prognoser. Efter det oväntade resultatet i det amerikanska presidentvalet riktades kritiken framförallt mot de bedrägliga algoritmernas sätt att skapa filterbubblor. Varför hade inte Facebook upplyst användarna om att detta kunde inträffa? Varför fanns det inga varningsklockor som signalerade att budskapen i flödet var enahanda som ljud i en ekokammare? Den här boken tecknar en bild av den stora bubbla som omger oss alla och av hur tekniken som skapar bubblor styr vårt sätt att uppfatta världen. Manipulativa algoritmer, täta filterbubblor och falska nyheter har gjort det svårare än någonsin att tränga igenom informationsflödet för att skaffa sig en välunderbyggd uppfattning om samtiden. Omöjligt är det dock inte. Boken hjälper dig att avkoda de digitala medier vi tar för självklara genom att börja vid källan. Att förstå logiken som strukturerar källkoden, den som styr algoritmerna som skapar filterbubblorna som gör att vi tycks ha så svårt att skilja falska nyheter från äkta. Genom att förstå hur medierna är konstruerade lär vi oss samtidigt hur de konstruerar vårt sätt att se på världen och därmed hur vi kan agera för att motverka det, bland annat genom att lära oss grundläggande källkritik. Ekokammare av musik. Vardagliga beteenden, som hur vi använder media, tar till oss nyheter eller konsumerar musik, tar tid att förändra. Det är svårt att byta beteende över en natt. Men sker förändringen i små steg upplevs den som förenkling eller som något som vi människor redan gör, och då anpassar vi oss förvånansvärt snabbt och utan att tänka så mycket på det. För att synliggöra hur mycket våra medievanor förändrats under bara något decennium kan vi se till hur musikindustrin förändras under samma tid. Algoritmerna som styr Spotify, Apple Music och andra strömningstjänster ger oss förslag på nya artister och nya låtar utifrån det vi redan gillar. Inledningsvis känns det toppen eftersom algoritmerna verkligen underlättar sökande efter ny musik. Men efter ett tag kommer känslan att vara fast i en ekokammare smygande när man aldrig får några andra förslag än artister och låtar från en viss genre. En dag för inte så länge sedan upptäckte jag att samtliga artister som Spotify föreslog för mig var amerikanska singer-songwriters. Det enda som återstod var långsamma, fylliga röster ackompanjerade på gitarr eller piano. Norah Jones, James Blunt, Joni Mitchell, Ellie Goulding, Tracy Chapman. Problemet är att jag inte gillar sån musik. Inte bara i alla fall. Min musiksmak är betydligt mer blandad än så. Men på något sätt verkar algoritmerna ha fäst större vikt vid just de här artisterna, vilket först gjorde mig irriterad och sen arg. Varför fungerar inte algoritmen som den borde? Och varför kunde jag i så fall inte nollställa algoritmen eller be den att indexera informationen om vad jag har lyssnat på än en gång så att det kunde bli rätt? Jämför man musikflödet med nyhetsflödet är det egentligen ingen skillnad. De fungerar på samma sätt och enligt samma logik. Den stora skillnaden är förstås att du kan höra när ditt musikflöde blir en ekokammare, bokstavligt talat. Vid några tillfällen i den här boken ska vi därför ta en omväg via musiken. Genom att förstå hur några artister slog igenom och hur allmänheten reagerade när de fick höra artisterna dött. Då kan vi jämföra medievanorna i olika tider, hur nyheterna förmedlas och hur de tas emot. I bokens sista del har jag sammanfatt några saker du kan göra för att bilda en korrekt bild av världen och för att undvika att fastna i en stor, tät bubbla. Donald Trumps förhållande till musik är till stora delar okänt. I en intervju med BBC berättade han dock att han tyckte om att lyssna på Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Elton John och Eminem. Citat: "Om du älskar en viss sorts musik, låt då inte andras musiksmak påverka dig", slutcitat, skrev Trump i boken Think Like a Billionaire från 2004. Citat: "Det som är bäst för dig är helt enkelt bäst", slutcitat. Rådet att skapa en ekokammare med musik man redan vet att man tycker om påminner om hans önskemål om att bara få positiva nyheter i mappen med pressklipp. Den allra farligaste filterbubblan är illusionen att man har koll på läget. Såväl algoritmer som bekräftelsejäv bidrar naturligtvis till att förstärka en sån uppfattning. Men det krävs också ett mått av narcissism för att tro att man redan har en korrekt bild av verkligheten. En ovilja att ta emot ny information eller influenser från nya källor är ett oroande tecken, då det tyder på att man redan tror att man har den kunskap man behöver. Det är ett sundhetstecken att tvivla på sin egen uppfattning om världen.